the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery will get you pretty much anything you want. If it's a John Deere product, they can get it. Also, they have Honda.
Ta-da!
Generators.
Oh.
Yeah. Go by and see them. Summer's just around the corner. We'll have fire season.
Honda generators, they're quiet.
Oh, they're very quiet. Very dependable. And, well, they're so good, people will steal them. So.
It's so great. They'll break in at 3 o'clock in the morning to get one.
Just to get one,
the five-finger discount.
That's right. Yeah, so go by and see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
It's probably a 10-finger discount, though. They're kind of heavy.
Yeah, they are. In fact,
for those of you that aren't old and don't know what that means, you'll have to look that up.
We did get a little chortle. We had them all on camera, and they couldn't get the last one in the van because it was too heavy, so they just left it in the parking lot.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah.
That's a thieves that don't plan very well.
No.
Okay. So you can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. There's a lot of information from today's show. Today is January 17th, 2021, in case we replay this at a later date. But wanted you to know that the interview with the congressman in the first hour has a lot of backup information online, and I really do hope that you go look at it because it's pretty informative. And we will also have commercial-free archives of both shows up later on today. So if you're out doing something because it's a kind of a nice day, I mean, you might be snowed in, depends on where you live. But if you missed part of this or all of it, wait till the commercial-free thing comes out, and you can listen for free. So our guest this hour, I'm kind of excited. We've waited a few weeks to get this put together. His name is Peter Wood. He's the president of the National Association of Scholars. No pressure, Bill. Get on your thinking cap. He's the author of a new book called 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. He's the former professor of anthropology and a college provost. He's the author of several books about American culture, including Diversity, the Invention of a Concept. Wasn't that some invention, too, 2003. And A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now, 2007. And I think that was way ahead of its time. Probably going to have to do a sequel. A frequent media guest. He does all sorts of television and radio. And I'm just excited to have him on because I think that this 1619 project is something that has been thrown around in passing, but I'm not sure people really realize what that is and what the significance is. So I'm really happy to have you with us, Mr. Wood.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you just fire away and let us know what I mean. Let's just figure most of us out here in the rest of the world. We'll just start with the fact that we're not part of the National Association of Scholars, which is why we've never met. but we have stayed at the Holiday Inn Express, so there's hope for us.
They're still looking over my application.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Bill's caught in processing. But I don't think people really realize how dangerous this is. I mean, in all seriousness, this is a rewrite of history.
That's exactly what it is. In August of 2019, the New York Times published a special issue of its Sunday magazine titled The 1619 Project, so that's where it begins. And it is set up as a complete redo of American history. It ends on its last page with the announcement by the Pulitzer Center that they will be rolling it out as a curriculum in the nation's schools, and they've lived up to that. So
they're teaching this?
Oh, yeah. It's being taught in the schools right now, or at least some schools. It's a kind of hard question of which schools. We know Chicago and Buffalo have both formally adopted it among some districts, but in many cases they've gone directly to teachers, so the district may not even know that it's being taught in some of their classrooms.
Oh,
so
lovely. Give us a thumbnail of what it is that they're teaching, because I think that'll be illuminating for people.
Well, the 1619 Project is so named because it starts with the claim that in August of 1619, 400 years earlier, slaves had been brought to Jamestown, Virginia. That was the beginning of slavery in America, they say, and that becomes also the beginning of what the Times called slaveocracy or white supremacy, and that since then, every significant detail in American history has depended on the perpetuation of slavery or its descendant institutions like Jim Crow laws, and that this is a story of America that, rightly understood, is about white supremacy beginning to end. Oppression Studies 101. There are a lot of problems with this, which were apparent the moment I picked it up and started reading it. One is the notion that the America's ideals were false when they were written. That's a direct quote. The ideals in question are liberty and equality, that those were simply disguises that were put up to prevent people from challenging the new forms of racial oppression. The claim that slavery began in Virginia in August of 1619 is false in a whole bunch of ways. The claim that the American Revolution was fought in order to perpetuate slavery is false. The idea that Abraham Lincoln brought about the Civil War in order to exile black Americans to another continent is false. The idea that the American economy is based on plantation slavery and that the prosperity of the capitalist system derives directly from how plantations were run is false. The idea that black advances in civil rights have always and only been due to the self-help of blacks with no help from whites is false. And you can go on like that. This document is made up of a long, long string of claims that don't stand the inspection of anybody who knows the actual history.
And I'm sorry, who was the author, the original author of this?
Well, the original author and editor is a woman named Nicole Hannah Jones. The 1619 Project consisted of 10 essays, so she has 9 co-authors, as well as the senior editor from the Times named Jake Silverstein. And then there were a couple dozen smaller contributions to this, ranging from photographs to drawings to poems. So it's a collaborative effort. It's presented with no historical sources at all. It's just straight-out narrative without any reference to people or documents or sources of information that would have made it checkable in an easy way. So we have this mythology basically presented as though it was history, and it's accompanied by quotations that say, basically, we're telling the true history for the very first time. Well, it may be doing something for the very first time, but true history it is not.
No.
And just not citing any sources. That's pretty. Right. That's not exactly how scholarly works are done.
No, it's not. But, of course, this is a newspaper, and newspapers generally don't write history. They report news. And I think the Times deliberately decided that this was going to be a new venture for them. They've treated it that way. Unlike other stories they've printed, this one got its own advertising budget. They ran 60-second television advertisements, one of them during the Super Bowl. So they were willing to spend quite large amounts of money to get this into the public ear and eye. And I think they've succeeded.
Wow.
That's just stunning. It's just stunning. And so,
it's stunning, too, that the school systems just pick it up and run with it without any background or investigating of their own.
Well, I think it tells you something about the nature of the education that many teachers now receive, that they are not really skeptical about this kind of claim. For a good many years now, one of the most popular textbooks in the country has been Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., and it, too, is a fabric of distortions and claims that don't stand the light of day. The people who promote the Howard Zinn approach to history have taken up the 1619 project with enthusiasm. So there are segments of the world of teachers and education that kind of endorse the idea that America is a rotten place, has been from the very start. It's founded on genocide, oppression, the demeaning of people in order to control them or extract their labor from them. It is a picture of our country that is just not recognizable if you have spent any time at all reading actual history.
But if you're a kid in school, and this is where you're learning history, you're not going to hear the other side unless your parents are really paying attention.
This will be your first exposure to history, and it'll be just amazing.
And so we can have a whole new crop of people who are wholly misinformed. What a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
God, you know, it's funny, if you were evil and bad, this is a great time to be alive. I guess it's always been a great time to be alive, but what the heck? All right, we have to take a really quick break so we can be incensed in our cone of silence here. And we're going to come back with our guest, Peter Wood. He has written a book called 1620, and I really do think you're going to learn a lot this hour if, in fact, you can keep your hair from catching on fire. So switch to decaf and join us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You're taking my life, so take my soul. Good.
Oh, isn't that the truth of it? Wow, this is, I read through all the material that your fabulous publicist, Stephen Manfredi, sent to us. God bless him. He really does a great job of sending us folks like you that might not be heard. And if somebody wasn't interested in the topic, they might not know of the book, which would just be a crime. Absolutely a crime that this stuff is going on right under everyone's nose. And it would be allowed. I mean, everyone knows the New York Times, you know, publishes crap, but, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I don't think, it's not like that's, you know, an authoritative publication anymore. But he had sent us a list of questions, and okay, it's just a personality problem, but, you know, you send me a list of questions. Those are not the ones I'm using. But he actually has some really good points in here. You probably helped him with it. That it says here that it's part of a larger effort to destroy America. Expand on that, because I really think that that's true.
Well, it's a big claim on my part, but I think that it is true. America really depends on people having some confidence that our liberties, our freedoms, our sense of equality are justified and real, and that our nation is not simply a place of run by bandits for their own good. If you teach people that their right response to America is to hate the place, there really is no fabric of a civil society. There's no possibility of sustaining a country based on self-hatred. So when I say destroy America, I mean destroying the value base that enables us to live with one another even when we disagree.
Well, and I think we all see that now. The people who, you know, are looting and burning, you know, our major cities and all those kinds of things. It's pretty clear just in that behavior and then what comes out of that. That they do hate the country, and these people haven't even been indoctrinated with stuff like the 1619 Project. They're not even in school anymore, for the most part.
No, they're not, but the 1619 Project leaped beyond the control of the times pretty quickly. In July, I think it was, Charles Kessler, the head of the Claremont Institute, made a comment that the riots that had broken out post George Floyd's death could be called the 1619 riots. Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is the principal author of this thing and a ferocious Twitterer, responded almost immediately saying, yes, bring it. I accept that they are the 1619 riots. That's a slight paraphrase, but she owned that comment. Why? What did the riots have to do with 1619? Well, 1619 is saying America was racially unjust from the beginning, and every aspect of its continuing life, its prosperity, those businesses that got burned down, the law enforcement authorities are all people who are part of the great racist conspiracy. So going out and having yourself a little riot was no big deal. Once the property destruction started to mount up to many, many millions of dollars, Nicole Hannah-Jones thoughtfully explained to the world that that wasn't violence. Violence is when you attack a person, but burning down a building or a courthouse or some small business, that's not violence, that's just protest. So we have the 1619 Project on record by its primary author as something that says the hatred of America can legitimately be expressed by trying to destroy the place. She's not alone in that. I think what we have in 1619 becomes apparent when you look at the pictures of statues that have been toppled, like George Washington, spray painted once he's down on the ground, 1619. It's now a signature by the looters and rioters to call what they're doing 1619.
Oh.
So we are, we're in a world that the Times helped to create. Now the Times, of course, has, the vapors when it sees a couple hundred people roaming through the hallways of Congress, but
they're rioters.
They're pretty much okay with the idea that black neighborhoods can be burned down and small business owners who are themselves black can be have their livelihoods destroyed and their property vanished.
And police. Don't forget the police. We only care about them if they work at the Capitol.
Exactly.
It's just, okay, so they've taken our whole history, made it upside down. Is this something you can only really find online? It's not, 1619 Project is not really like a book or anything like that?
Well, that's a really good question. They did not bring it out as a book. They published it in that original magazine form, and I'm grateful that I had the foresight to save it. They went through a period of about 7 or 8 months in which, despite being told by many prominent historians, mostly people on the left themselves, that it was full of inaccuracies, they stubbornly refused to make any corrections or changes. It just stood available online in the form it was originally published. Then a historian named Harris, a woman who teaches American history, who had been called on to fact-check the original document before it was published, came forward on Politico to say she had warned them that they were committing major errors, and they refused to fix them. After she criticized them, they went back and made one tiny correction in the whole document. It was two words, and the words were "some of," and they got inserted at a place where instead of the American Revolution being fought by the colonists to preserve slavery, only some of the colonists were fighting for that reason. Well, the historical fact is none of them were, because it just wasn't an issue at the time. But that was the only change they made, and after that, the original record vanished. Only the revised record was available. Then something more happened. In September, President Trump gave a talk at the National Archives in which he called out the 1619 Project for its falsehoods. And instead of the project becoming an instrument to bludgeon him with, it looked like it was going to become something that the New York Times would get bludgeoned with. At that point, the Times did something really sneaky. They went back into the document and changed a lot of things. They paraphrased them. They reduced the more absurd claims to something that were slightly more defensible. And they did this without any public acknowledgement that they were making corrections. It's called stealth editing, and it's one of the worst things you can do as a journalist, which is to change your published words without acknowledging that that's what you're doing. Well, we called them on that. I got together a group of about 20 historians. We sent a public letter to the Pulitzer Foundation saying, given that they just provided Nicole Hannah-Jones a Pulitzer Prize for her journalism, here she is showing how undeserving she is of that prize and they should revoke it. Of course they didn't, but the mere asking for it, I think, helped draw some public attention to how sleazy this enterprise really is.
Wow. Can't hurt. It goes through all this fake history, but I think your point is well taken, that fake history is more dangerous even than fake news, because we spend a lot of time looking at the fake news. We have like a minute till our break, but from your vantage point, why do you say that?
Fake history pollutes our minds for generations at a time, and there is no easy way to correct it once it gets the authority of schools and colleges behind it. Most of us don't go back and read original historical sources searching for the truth of matters. We take what is presented publicly as pretty much face value. As you say, fake news gets corrected pretty quickly. At least 75 million of us know certain things happened that others are saying didn't happen, and no matter how much that gets shut down, we know the truth. I think it's going to be harder when it comes to something like the 1619 Project, something like the idea that slavery began in America in 1619 sounds somewhat plausible. Who knows what happened back in Jamestown then? Well, I won't try to give you all the details right now, but what the Times said happened just didn't happen. So,
when we come back, I want you to tell people why you called it your book 1620, because I kind of skipped over that at the beginning, but I think that's a good point, and I think it's important really for people to know that this is out there, and especially people with kids in school, even college age kids, they should be asking, are you hearing this at school?
Yeah. And also, 1620 is a book.
Yeah, it's written by a scholar.
That's
right. Oh, my
gosh,
what a great idea. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Wood. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
In your ears, you turn around, come around back on you. Well, that little white lie's catching up to you.
Far from little white lies, but they didn't have any songs about big lies that I had available anyway. I had to go with the little lies. So you called your book 1620, and that wasn't just because it was a year after 1619, right?
No, it was not. It was because something important happened in 1620 that I think is of great importance more than anything that happened the year before. That was in November of 1620, a ship arrived off the coast of Massachusetts, bringing with it a bunch of religious dissenters from Holland, along with some would-be farmers who were headed to Virginia. The ship had been blown off course and had arrived much later in the season than anyone expected, and dissension had broken out on board. The religious group, the people we call pilgrims, and the would-be settlers, whom the pilgrims called the strangers, became angry with each other. The strangers said they had sailed across the Atlantic on a contract with a British land company, and now that they weren't in Virginia, they were free to go where they would want to go and do whatever they wanted. The pilgrims were saying that's probably not a very good plan, given that we don't have any food. It's too late to plant any crops, and we don't know what kind of reception we're going to get from the natives. So they sat down, and they worked out an agreement, which we call the Mayflower Compact. That was signed on November 11th, 1620. And why that short document, it's fewer than 200 words, matters is that it laid out for the very first time a vision of self-government in the New World. They decided that they were now outside English law, so they were going to elect their own leaders. They were going to decide on their own laws in a democratic way. They were going to abolish hierarchy. So this document was signed by the servants as well as the masters, by the young under age 21 as well as the elders. It became a charter for a new way of thinking of a self-governing community. It wasn't just a piece of paper. Once they got on shore, they put it into practice, and it remained in force for 25 years, during which time the later groups of religious dissenters we call the Puritans arrived and sort of took over. But the Mayflower Compact gave rise to a community that was able to reach and sustain a treaty with the local Wampanoag Indians. It provided a form of the rule of law based on equality. It was a genuine breakthrough in world history at that point. The whole idea of self-government by a bunch of people who disagreed with each other but saw the need to hang together. The model of what happened at Plymouth became a basic template for the settlement first of New England and then of much of the rest of America. Our ideals of small-town government derive from the Mayflower Compact. Therefore, if you're going to go back to the very early days of English settlement of the New World, you can find something that really does sustain itself in a positive way over the next 400 years. And it's not slavery. There were no slaves in Plymouth. Never were. And then we are in a path here, I think, to a better understanding of who we are and where our values come from. Some call the Mayflower Compact an early draft of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration is, of course, a much more eloquent, serious document that lays out our vision of our really core values. But everything that's there is got a predecessor in the Mayflower Compact. It's a short document worth knowing.
Yeah, they had it on display, actually, at the Library of Congress a few years back. I happened to be in there at the time, and I was surprised at the size. I mean, it's such a...
tiny.
It's such a... kind of like Plymouth Rock. I mean, two men and a boy could pick that up. But the Mayflower Compact was not very big, and yet it did set the stage for so much more.
So when did the slave trade hit our shores?
Well, there's several layers to the answer. First, it was here already by the time European settlers arrived. Slavery had been practiced in both North and South America for at least over 1,000 years that we can tell. Native American tribes practiced slavery. They enslaved each other, and when Europeans came along and could be captured, they were enslaved as well. So slavery is an indigenous institution in that sense. But then when the Spanish found that enslaving the Indians wasn't working out very well for them, they started importing slaves from West Africa, and the Portuguese and the Spanish both were bringing over slaves in very large numbers starting in the 1500s. And so more than 100 years before Jamestown, there were millions of slaves already in North America brought over by Spanish and Portuguese, Portuguese to Brazil, the Spanish to everywhere else. The English did not take up an interest in slavery until later. So here we have the claim about Jamestown goes wrong in another way. I mean, those people who were brought to Jamestown by an English pirate ship in August of 1619 were not recognized as slaves by the Virginians. They didn't have a legal status of slavery, so they turned these 20-some captives into indentured servants, and a short time later let them go free. Some of them intermarried with the white population. Some of them became prosperous landowners. We know that they had full legal rights because of their entry into the court system, where they sued and won against white neighbors. So what we had in 1619, contrary to the New York Times, is an early and kind of odd experiment in racial integration. Slavery lay in the future.
Hmm. Well, that certainly would be nice to know if you were in grade school or
yeah,
high school.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and this doesn't... I think that things like this sometimes aren't opposed because people are chicken, but on a broader level, they think, well, you know, it was bad, and this will help. I guess this will help racial issues now.
I think you put your finger right on it. I think a lot of people who could know better or should know better are thinking, well, it may not be exactly true that this is a good way to recognize how bad the country has been to people of African origin, and maybe if we just squint at this, it'll do some good. It'll make people feel better. But I don't think you make people feel better by teaching them lies. Or maybe you do make them feel better, but the consequences for that are going to be pretty dire later on.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what you get when you start tearing down statues and all that. They believe that, you know, that's bad history. So
yeah, we'll get rid of those people, and if we don't talk about them, they weren't there.
Yeah.
Which obviously isn't how that works. But, you know, the other part of it is I think that all of this has just stoked racial tension. It hasn't actually helped.
I think it was intended to stoke racial tension. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of accomplishment by the authors of it that they succeeded in doing that. We're living in an era right now in which animosity based on identity is taken as a matter of pride. In your intro to me, you mentioned a book that I had written some time back titled A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now, which is really about our turning anger into a virtue when it used to be seen as kind of dangerous and maybe something that you wanted to get under control. Well, my book is now about 15 years old, and the publisher wants to bring out a new edition, and so I'm working on that as my next project. But it connects to this. This is an era in which stoking anger, even if you have to engage in deception to do it, is seen as such a good thing. Anger is empowering. People won't really stand up and fight for what you want them to fight for unless you can rouse them to some degree of fury. I don't think that's something that happens entirely on the left, but it is the left's specialty. You know,
it's their specialty, and I think that in a lot of cases the right has adopted that as well, and you can see it, you know, people see that in their emails. You see it in your emails. You get these emails that they don't tell you what the legislation is, but they are passing a bill about blah, blah, blah. Don't tell you what it is, so you can go look it up. They just give you some incendiary clip of it, and we're going to fight it. Send us money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's become a tool. And besides that, people aren't very smart when they're angry, and that's not usually where you do your best thinking when you're mad. So if we keep everybody mad... nobody will see through any of this, and they'll just race from fight to fight. I don't know.
Anger brings a kind of clumsiness that's intellectual mostly, but it's physical too. Mm-hmm. And in the martial arts, you're taught to fight with a cool head, not to get mad. So here we are teaching people to be mad first and then think later, if at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Don't stop and don't do any research, for heaven's sakes. We just need to believe.
Well, that's already been done for you.
Yeah, we just need to believe what people tell us. And you know, it almost is always true when it sounds so far out there and so like this. Those of us who are over 10 years old know that the country wasn't founded on slavery, I think. And so when you hear something like that, and your internal buzzer ought to go off, you know, hey, wait a minute, there might be something funky going on with this. We're going to be right back with the author of 1620. His name is Peter Wood. You can find that at encounterbooks.com. And I think this is actually, I guess Christmas is over, but what is it? Valentine's Day is coming up. This would be a terrific Valentine's present. I think you ought to consider investing. When we come back, we'll find out how big the book is. Not to spoiler alert it for people, but we'll find out how scholarly it is and how long it will take you to read it. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You see, it's all clear. You are meant to be here from the beginning.
Truth. Everybody does want to rule the world. So give us a spoiler alert. Is this a hardback book, a softback book? Is it big? Is it little?
it's a hardback book.
Nice.
With a delightfully pretty cover that has gotten some nice comments on Amazon. So it's a book that you can put out and not be ashamed to have on your table. It's about 250 pages long.
Oh, and there you go.
It's very readable. One of the things I can boast about, because it's not my doing, is that the publisher just made a nice book out of it. I think that at its current length and style, most people could probably read it within a few days. I did not intend it to be a heavyweight scholarly book that was going to put people off. My whole idea here was to present this to the public in a manner that made it as accessible as possible.
That's awesome, because I think sometimes when you written by the president of the National Association of Scholars, people are like, yawning. you know, it might be boring.
Does it have pictures? Aaron likes pictures.
Aaron was an English major. It's Bill who goes for pictures. Let's just be clear there.
I tried to put pictures in it, but the pictures I wanted were images from the New York Times. And for some reason, they decided that the prices that they were going to charge me for those were through the roof. So
that's one way of keeping them from being called on the carpet. Well, that's an important point, though, because I think sometimes when we're talking about a response to a rewrite of history, it might seem like, well, I don't really need to know this. But, you know, the things that you're going to talk about in this book will be things that we learned in school, I'm sure.
They should be the things that everybody learned in school. I'm not quite as confident about people who graduated from high school in the last 10 years or so. They may well have already been consuming versions of our history that I wouldn't recognize, but there we go.
That is just so creepy. I mean, we're old, so, you know, and I grew up on the East Coast, so I learned all the Revolutionary War and all of that history. It's all right around you.
You didn't know squat about Sutter's Fort, though.
No, I didn't. And I was pretty dopey about the missions, too. We were busy visiting actual historical sites. But I think that things like this, do you see this? I'm just guessing, but I'm probably, it's probably unfortunately correct. This is probably picking up steam.
I think it is. I say that, however, without real hard evidence. The Pulitzer Center, which was responsible for rolling it out to the schools, decided after a while they weren't going to tell you anymore how many teachers had adopted it or which school districts were using it. I think they caught on that that information could be of value to the opposition. So right now it's kind of tough to figure out how far it's penetrated in the schools. As you know, we already mentioned that the rioters like to spray paint 1619 on their handiwork, so I think it's pretty broadly disseminated amongst the radicals, the Black Lives Matter, the Antifa folks. They know it chapter and verse. What's less clear to me is what ordinary Americans of all races actually know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Back before the Great Shutdown, when I would ask live audiences who had heard of the 1619 Project, so this was 6-7 months after it had been published, virtually nobody had. It had at that point gained a lot of ground in the schools without penetrating the public awareness of it. I think that changed dramatically when President Trump at that speech at the National Archives brought it up. I spoke that day as well, and it was clear that the White House staff were now on top of this. Now, what happens next, I think, is really worth paying attention to. I would not be surprised if President Biden thinks that the 1619 Project is exactly what the country needs, but I don't want to prejudge it. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, they'll have a lot of other bad ideas that might, you know, happen first, but I'm sure
precedent.
It's on the list. Tell me this. What is, besides learning about it, I mean, if you don't know about it, you can't fight it, but what would be your advice? One of the last things that Stephen included for us is, what can the average citizen do?
Well, I think there are several things the average citizen can do. First, find out whether it's being taught in your schools, and don't assume that when the school board says it's not, that answer is definitive, because the Times has marketed it over the heads of the school boards. It's bad enough if the school board is in favor of it, but if it is, then you may want to consider running for the school board or promoting a candidate who is determined to stop this particular disgrace. A second thing that you can do is reacquaint yourself with some basic American history. The stories of what happened, what really happened, are dramatic and they fully hold interest. You can't really bore people to death by getting the narrative of what happened at Concord and Lexington restated, or Bunker Hill for that matter, or the Pilgrims. I think that's a story that can hold its own. It doesn't have to be treated with a candy coating. It was a story of immense suffering and overcoming. Worth knowing, you cannot teach your children those stories unless you have a feel for them yourself, and that takes a little bit of effort, not a great deal, but acquaint yourself or reacquaint yourself with some American history and bring it up at the dinner table or whenever. People are home a lot these days, and it's a good opportunity to open up a conversation in which you can give your children a sense of the American past that they probably are not going to get in their schools. Or if they are going to get it in their schools, it's going to be all the better that they've already heard some version of it from their parents. Remember, school teachers are treated by children, at least before high school, as pretty much authorities. What they say, kids accept because they don't ever hear anything different. Well, maybe this is a case where they should hear something different, so that they have some immunity when their teachers start telling them things that are false. So those are the two simple things that every American can do, and I strongly recommend doing them. There are other more complicated things you can do, like, you know, buy 100 copies of my book and send it to your friends.
Yeah.
But there are other organizations like the 1776 Unites, which is a black group that is promoting alternatives to the 1619 Project, that are well worth knowing about. So if you begin to dig into this stuff, you'll find that there are other avenues to try to influence public opinion. And, you know, while you're at it, maybe you should cancel your subscription to the New York Times if you have one. I feel obliged to read it, but I'm reading it for you.
Yeah, and, that makes one of us. Tell me this. I realize ideas like this can be marketed to any age group, but what do you feel the target age is, or what are you hearing, or what's your research shown? What's the target age where they want to roll this out?
Well, the curriculum that they've put forth is broken into pieces to make it right for every grade level, starting with first grade. So some version of this is reaching children at a very young age. I think the main thrust of it, though, is probably for junior high and high school, where kids begin to get naturally a little bit cynical or skeptical, and here's a version of history that says everything that's been taught up till this very moment has been a lie, and now we're telling you the truth. I think people fall for that gimmick quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The Times magazine itself was, I think, intended for a mostly adult audience, at least, you know, those folks who generally see themselves as righteous liberals who want to show that they're on the right side of history, and that means getting rid of white supremacy and anything that can be shoved into that category. So there is an appeal to the elite as well as to the students.
Sure. Well, I mean, how many times did you hear that the events at the Capitol on the 6th was obviously about racism because the people were white? And it's like, well, I guess I'm not connecting those dots. I'm almost 60. I was taught that if your premise is about the color of someone's skin, that is racism. And I wasn't taught that it was because people were black. That was just, if it's about your skin color, something you can't fix, it's just
I think that's a
straight up racism.
Perfectly accurate definition of what racism is. But, of course, racism is being redefined by these folks. That they now say it's asymmetrical. It's only whites who hate blacks and don't even know it because now it's implicit racism.
Yeah, because they're white, and how would they know? Oh,
yeah.
Gosh. We have entered the ring of insanity. Peter Wood, thank you for spending the hour with us. I cannot believe we're out of time. I hope everybody runs out and gets 1620, a critical response to the 1619 Project. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. You've been listening to We the People. You can find the archives on these shows for today at wethepeopleradio.us.